This is Lele Pons from Suite 305 with Lele Pons. Game day at my house, it's chaos, but like in a fun way. The TV's ready, the remotes are ready, the kids' toys are going off, and somehow everybody needs batteries at the exact same time. That's why I keep Duracell stocked. And Duracell just released limited edition Duracell and Messi battery packs. The design is inspired by Messi's iconic left leg tattoo. So every battery feels like it comes with an extra kick. From the TV remote to automatic corkscrew, Duracell keeps us game day ready. Duracell double and triple A batteries are the only ones built different with power boost ingredients for long-lasting performance you can trust. Find the limited edition Duracell and Messi batteries in stores at Lowe's and Walmart or on Amazon.
It's called soccer.
It's called football.
Soccer.
Football.
Domino's best deal ever lets you get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, fully.
So, pineapple?
Don't ruin it.
Get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99. Finally, something everyone can get behind.
And if the rest disagree, that's between them and Domino's. Which means the only thing left to fight over is who's ordering.
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6:15 to 7:26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings. 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.
Merkle Media.
I guess it's time to go back in time.
Are you telling me you built a time machine? Out of a DeLorean?
Time is but a stubborn illusion.
I have a lot of memories of the past.
People are time traveling within themselves.
Time travel is possible.
This was all circulating around the base that a giant had been killed, but no one was supposed to talk about it.
I saw three long bony fingers reach up underneath the door, curl up to grab it, and then disappear.
When he came over to me, dude, he slithered over to me.
And this giant comes out of the cave and they're all frozen. And he starts running and firing at this giant. But the giant moves. He's got a spear in one hand and he's running really fast and spears Dan and holds him up like this. Somebody yells, shoot him in the face, shoot him in the face. They basically decapitate him.
Got closer. When he got about 15 yards away from me, I raised that 12 gauge and I blow his head off.
I feel something pulling at my leg. And I look over and there are two small gray entities pulling at me. And they're literally, I'm getting pulled off the bed.
I reached my hand into this bush and I touch air. Couldn't breathe and I couldn't move because I know I'm seeing a monster.
Okay, I'll reload it.
Welcome to the show, everybody. You're listening to the Confessionals Podcast. I'm your host, Tony Merkel. Thanks for being here. If you have a crazy, wild experience you want to share with me on the show, go ahead and shoot me an email. My email address is contact@theconfessionalspodcast.com. That's contact@theconfessionalspodcast.com. Or go to the website, theconfessionalspodcast.com, hit the contact section, and you can reach me that way as well. Either way works for me, just get a hold of me. If you want more shows on a weekly basis, we got you covered. Whether you're a member on the website, theconfessionalspodcast.com, or a member on YouTube, you can get the Thursday shows for members only, and you can get the overtime segments to the Tuesday shows when they are available right there on the members' website or on the membership section on YouTube. Also, MerkelFilms.com, that's where we have our documentaries, and Sasquatch and the Missing Man will be available very soon on demand at MerkelFilms.com. Stay tuned for that. If you missed the world premiere, it's okay. It will be available on demand at MerkelFilms.com very, very soon. All right, today we have James Shubsky coming on the show today. He is a returning guest, and we had a great conversation. The first time was a heater. This time was awesome, too. He was talking about investigating certain areas and seemingly being teleported back to locations. Wild stuff happening in his neck of the woods. And he also talks about his time in the service. And he didn't want to say it, but I'm going to say it. James Shupsky might be a super soldier. When you hear this story, you might agree with me. So let's get to James right now. All right, today we have James Shupsky on the show. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. Yourself?
Man, I'm glad you're here. And listen, I just got to get it off the chest, right off the start. I told you I was going to do this. Episode 591, you were on episode 591, and we called it The Secret Guardian of Hanford. And that episode was, like, I remember sitting there thinking, I don't know if I've had this much fun doing an episode in such a long time. Like, it was such a good episode. And I just feel like the audience didn't respond well to it because I titled it bad. And so every once in a while, like, especially if I have a really good episode, sometimes I tend to overthink the title, and because I want to tell people what it's about and really kind of grab them with the title, right? And looking back at it, I'm like, The Secret Guardian of Hanford. If people don't know what Hanford is, they probably don't even care if it has a secret guardian. And and then on the show art for it was a giant cat. I'm like, yeah, that doesn't make any sense to anybody. And so I just want to tell people the reason why James is back is because the first time I had him on, it was a really good conversation. So we're doing a round two. And if you missed out on that first one, you got to go check it out. Episode 591, The Secret Guardian of Hanford. And before we get into today's conversation and stuff, maybe let's give them a brief overview as to what the Klickitat Ape Cat is, because that's what they're getting into.
So, as you know, my wife and I inherited businesses here in the Columbia River Gorge, which is southern Washington, forms the border between Washington and Oregon. And this is a huge paranormal hotspot, we came to find out. So we inherited these businesses. One of them is an outdoor adventure store. Right away, as soon as we started kind of getting ourselves settled, people started coming in and telling us all kinds of amazing stories about encounters with Sasquatch and UFOs and glowing orbs. And so we put up a big sign in the window. It said, file your paranormal reports here, and gave the employees really, I think, very important instructions that we're going to take everyone seriously. We're going to treat them with respect. And in just a little over 2 years, we have now, I think it's 312 reports that have been filed at the store. And it's a amazing range of, like, spans the whole gamut. You know, we've got ghost stories and portal stories. And the one that really kind of captured my attention, we have over 100 reports of an enormous, very mysterious Black Panther creature creeping around here in Klickitat County. And so everyone describes a very muscular, very large black furred cat. So of course we have cougars out here, but cougars are never supposed to be black. And so that's a weird thing. About half the reports explicitly state that the creature is enormous. And we're talking about 4 to 5 feet tall at the shoulder. So that's bigger than, way bigger than a cougar, which might come in at 24 inches, way bigger than a tiger. And in fact, the only creature that ever lived on Earth that matches that size is an Ice Age American lion called the Panthera atrox. This was an 1,100-pound cat that lived here in Washington State and supposedly went extinct 10,000 years ago. But yet we have all these reports of it. In fact, after I did the show with you, a guy came into the store because he had heard about this cat on your show. And he was up by Mount St. Helens, and he was driving home, and an enormous black cat jumped into the middle of the road, looked at him, then jumped over the guardrail and down a hill. He said that the cat that he saw was as tall as his Honda Civic. So that's 4.5 feet tall right there.
Jeez.
So tons of reports. Like I said, about half of them described this enormous size. And then a very small percentage of them, about maybe 10%, describe that it has, a face that looks like a monkey. So ape-like features. And, so right now it's a huge mystery. There are some leads that, have to do with some of the, Native American traditions in the area, and a race of supernatural panther protectors, sometimes described as looking like a black panther with the face of a man. And then there's also a really compelling story from the other episode that says that this creature may have escaped from the animal testing laboratory at the Hanford nuclear site upriver. And Hanford was a part of the Manhattan Project, so ground zero for America's exploration into the atomic frontier. And the story is really amazing and a lot of fun to talk about, as we discussed last time. And so we've got this huge array of really astonishing things that people are reporting. You know, there's the gorge itself is 80 miles long. To the north, we're sort of bound by two stratovolcanoes, Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams, both of which, so St. Helens erupted in the 1980s. Mount Adams has been a UFO hotspot basically since the 1940s. In fact, some of the very first UFO reports in the country came from that area. And then to the south in Oregon, we're bound by Mount Hood, another stratovolcano, over 10,000 feet. And so the area is ruggedly wild, stunningly beautiful. We've got, you know, 90 waterfalls on the Oregon side of the gorge alone. Some of those are 600 feet tall. We've got brooding and mysterious Pacific Northwest rainforests on the west side of the mountains here. We've got this dry and sort of austere, almost spiritual desert area on the east half of the gorge. And so it really spans this amazing set of climates and biomes. There's over 600 caves in the area, whitewater rafting, rock climbing, mountaineering, windsurfing. It's a true adventurous paradise. And so for a guy like me who has, you know, I was a decorated infantry soldier, wildland forest firefighter, mountain guide, nationally certified search and rescue EMT, like this place is heaven. And then come to find out that it's populated by mysterious creatures and strange craft. I tell you, I feel like I'm living in heaven. Like this is the coolest, most interesting adventure exploration place I could possibly have imagined finding myself in. And it's awesome that the store has kind of got this reputation within the gorge. Like we are the sort of the hub of information about people bring their reports here. And we just opened up what we call the Gorge Paranormal Info Center. And I've picked up a replica skull of that Panthera atrox. It's an 18-inch long skull. It's humongous. And we put it next to like a cougar skull so people can tell the difference. We have a replica skull of Gigantopithecus, which is a creature in the fossil record that most matches Bigfoot. This creature was lived alongside human beings 200,000 years ago in China. And it is an ape that was 7 to 9 feet tall, very much seeming to be a creature from the fossil record that's like the creature described by many Sasquatch accounts. And then my favorite part in this little paranormal center, we've got a big map that shows, you know, where people have seen things and some information posters about the different phenomena people have experienced. But I built an 11-foot tall hairy Sasquatch and we put him up in the store. Nice. And so people can get a chance. You can come up and we named him Jeff. But
why Jeff?
Because it seemed like the most innocuous white guy name we could come up with.
I love it.
And so I have to tell you this kind of funny story. So I made it out of like this 2-inch insulating foam board. You know, it's like this pink foam you can put in buildings when you're insulating it. And it allowed me to cut out this really big, you know, 11-foot tall frame. And then I bought the big bolt of fur and I was trying to figure out how to, you know, attach it, and like staples would just pull out of this foam, and like glue with all that hair would have been a disaster. And so I realized that if I like carefully trimmed a small portion of it, I could like get a screw to drill in and that would hold it in place. And so I spent, you know, a whole Thursday afternoon, you know, carefully trimming spots of this Sasquatch out. And I had to make a choice, like, is he going to be facing you or walking away from you? And anytime you're facing, if you don't get the face right, it just looks cheesy and fake. So I said, I was going to be walking away. And there's some slack areas in the fur. And so I stuffed his buns with this sort of cotton batting. So he's got this nice big round rump. He's sort of walking away from you. And so people love coming in and patting Squatch's butt. But the kind of the embarrassing part about it is, you know, I had to get this fur attached to it. And so I actually had to spend time trimming Squatch's crack in order to get these screws into this foam board. You know, the things you do to show people what they're getting into. But it is really amazing. Like, there's nothing like you can hear about an 11-foot tall creature and you can imagine what that might be like. But I really wanted to give people a sense of, like, if you're in the woods and you encountered an animal that was 11 feet tall, like, you just come up, like, even a tall guy like myself, I'm 6'5", I just come up to his hip. Like, I'm looking like at his belly button, maybe. And it really is, it really brings it home. And we've had so many reports. Most of the reports are really, he's like between 7 and 10 feet tall. And then there's a few stories of alphas that we've heard where they can get as tall as 14 feet, which is, if you've never stood next to something 14 feet tall in the shape of a human, like, you really can't, it's so overwhelming. And it's also a really good case study in that if you're not looking up, like, it does, it just looks like tree trunks in front of you, you know? So we have a lot of fun with it. We love sort of being a safe place for people to come and tell their stories. And, you know, like I said, we've had over 300 of them. And some, you know, we can look at, and, you know, some have photographs and things like that. And we do image analysis to determine, you know, is this authentic or not? And there are sometimes things caught on the trail cam that look strange, turn out to be, you know, a bird in a weird position or something like that. But for the most part, you know, we didn't know how many people would just come in and file fun reports and how many people would file legitimate reports. But I would say it's easily 98% to 99% of the people are serious and genuine, and they're not fooling around, and they have had an unusual encounter here in the Columbia River Gorge area. It's been a remarkable and glorious and just incredibly satisfying experience so far.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing, man. I mean, when you present an environment for people to come and talk about their experiences and be taken serious, it allows them to come forward. And when word starts spreading around, you become a landing spot for that stuff. So Columbia River Gorge, if you're in that area, I mean, definitely check out the store. And what was the store called again?
It's Margie's Outdoor Store. So Margie was my mother-in-law. And so she started all this trouble. And gosh, we're just so lucky to be, you know, a part of it. And what's really great is that the gorge maybe has 80,000 people who live here, you know, over thousands and thousands of square miles. And so we do a lot of advertising, and we're involved in a lot of community projects. We, you know, support public arts. We've got public art on at our location. And a lot of people have come to know us and know me personally. And so I'll be, you know, at a restaurant and someone will stop me and tell me their story, or in the grocery store, or at the post office. And, you know, it's one of the true joys of living in a small town is sort of this community, and, you know, having, you know, that those kind of connections. It's, I can't tell you how, what a joy it is to be trusted in that way.
Absolutely. Well, listen, let's get into some of this stuff here. We talked about the Columbia River Gorge, and, you know, I'm assuming you didn't grow up in that area, right?
No, I grew up in Ohio, and my first real contact with the gorge was way back in 1988. I was a soldier stationed at Fort Lewis, and my buddies and I, when we weren't training in the field, we foolishly would head straight out to the field and go, like, rock climbing in the gorge and exploring the area. And it is, like I said, you know, back then I was 19, and it was coming from Ohio, just mind-blowing, you know, that there were these, you know, glacier-clad mountains, and these, you come to the gorge and there's these soaring, like, 600-foot tall cliffs, and you see things here that, you know, every day I drive to work, I see deer and turkey and bald eagles, and sometimes we'll see bear running across the road, or skunk, like river otters. It is like a wildlife preserve out here, and it's like I said, jaw-droppingly beautiful. Right now, the wildflowers are just rioting all over the hillsides, and you get up, especially into some of the more desert areas, and it's just splashed with color, and the air is perfumed. It's like living in a magical wonderland. And so, yeah, came out here way back in 1988, and then we moved down here after Margie passed away about 3 years ago. And these reports have been coming in. You know, I think you've seen pictures of my rig. We call it the cryptid. Yeah. And so when something recent or interesting comes up, I'll hop into the vehicle. And I mean, you'd absolutely need a four-wheel drive to access some of these areas. And because we're talking about deep, thick forests or, you know, trackless deserts and things like that. Like once you get out of the thin ribbon of humanity, that's the river, beyond that, it's like an ocean of trees that just goes on as far as the eye can see. And so some of these places are really fascinating to me. And the one that's really got my attention right now is an area we call Brook Lake Barrows. So about 8,000 years ago, the whole area north of the river is this gigantic volcanic complex. There's like, aside from the big mountains, Adams and St. Helens, there's over 250 volcanic vents out there. And it's been active for a long, long time. On maps, it's the Gifford-Pinchot National Forest. So it's public land. And then there are certain areas within that. Brook Lake Barrows is located in an area called Indian Heaven. This is maybe, 12 miles from the store. Not too far away, really. And so the way to imagine it is like some volcanoes form big mountains, right? Other ones just have lava pouring out of it. And so there's a small sort of cinder cone in the north end of this lava field. It's about 22 square miles. So imagine an area the size of the island of Manhattan, right? Mm-hmm. So sizable, like 1.7 million people live on Manhattan. So it's got a carrying capacity, like a stretch of land like this. And it's almost like, like this lava just sort of pours out and it just sort of fills the whole mountain valley. And you can go from side to side. It's some places it's 8 miles wide. And it's like, when you get out there, it's utterly silent. It's really a bizarre place. The rocks have formed like this giant jumble. Like it's sort of like this giant bulldozer of the lava that is pushing forward, and it just rolls this rock into these giant slabs. Sometimes it creates what they call a lava tube. So the lava will begin to flow. The top of the lava will cool and harden and form an insulating layer. And then the lava will continue to flow through this straw-like tunnel almost. Some of these can be miles and miles, like, you know, there's some that I think are over 20 miles long. And so then the lava will then flow all the way through it and then leave behind this empty chamber. It's almost like a gigantic, you know, like blood vessels of the earth. And so you get these astonishing caves. Like I said, there's over 600 of them in the area. And so sometimes those caves are 40 feet tall when you're inside of them. But with all the seismic activity around here, oftentimes they'll collapse and they'll form trenches. So you've got this huge mass of land, which has got this convoluted rock structures. There are these micro canyons and hidden caves. It's, you know, I've been doing land navigation at a professional level since I was 19 years old. You know, I joined the Army. And of course, you know, that's one of the key things. Way back in the 80s, we were not relying on GPS. It was all map and compass work. So you had to do old school, you know, it's time of iron sights. We didn't have, you know, any of the fancy optics that they have now. And so it was very much like you have to know your skills to be able to, you know, be effective as a soldier. And so I have navigated through swamps and rainforests and deserts and mountains and glaciers, like you name it. I have, you know, at a professional level, navigated through those types of terrain. And this place is easily the scariest and the worst terrain I've ever seen in my life. Like there's nothing, your movement isn't completely slowed. It's a really challenging place. a few months ago. So I've been trying to, I had heard that there are ways to get into this, like there's supposed to be this old 4x4 track that leads into it. And so you have to understand the reason why I'm so fascinated by it is that we've had numerous Sasquatch reports in the area. We've had many missing person reports in that area. We've had strange UFO activity in that area. And so as I've been exploring it, I had this really astonishing, what I'd call a spatial displacement experience, where I was traveling and then somehow transported to a different location. Very unsettling. And so just kind of want to give you a sense that this place is, for me, my current, like I said, it's my fascination. The reason why is that compasses don't work reliably in this area. Cell phones absolutely don't work. You get GPS satellites. I've taken my drone out there, and the drone has trouble acquiring GPS satellites in the area. Local hunters are terrified of going in there, and they refuse to hunt in there. There are no trails save this one crazy 4x4 scratch that, you know, maybe heads maybe a quarter mile into this thing. And it is a completely almost unearthly environment. You know, it was laid down about 8,000 years ago. And so there's these forests have tried to form there, but it's a hard living. You know, there's not a ton of water. And so they're kind of scraggly and weird. They're all covered with moss. The rocks themselves, you know, you think about the Lord of the Rings movies. And there's a point at the end of the first one where they're getting ready to head into Mordor. And this is when the whole fellowship is together. And the dwarf Gimli talks about this place called Amonweal. And he says, it is an impassable labyrinth of razor sharp rocks. And that is exactly what this place is like. Like it is, it's almost impossible to describe it if you haven't been there. And so this has been sort of my focus. And like I said, I had this really astonishing experience out there that I can't account for. Like I said, having been a professional land navigator with the military, and then again, as a search and rescue EMT, you know, I am the kind of person that you call when someone else is lost in the woods. And to have had this experience really kind of, well, it was very unsettling at first, and then kind of amazing that I had had it. You know, and I guess it might be helpful to talk a little bit about my military experience to give people some context.
Yeah.
So I joined the military when I was 19 years old, way back in 1988. And I specifically joined a special unit. It was an experimental unit called a cohort unit. And I was to be assigned to Fort Lewis and the 9th Infantry Division, which at the time was known as the Toys R Us Division, because it was the place where they tested new weapon systems, new vehicle systems. If they were doing something unusual with troops and training, like this was sort of the Army's sandbox to test stuff out. And they loved Washington State because it's got Fort Lewis, which is sort of in the rainforest part of it. And then there's this Yakima Firing Center on the other side of the mountains in the desert area. So you can train someone to be both, you know, a desert warrior and a forest warrior here. And so it gave them wide variability. And so the idea behind this cohort unit was the Army had done studies and they looked at situations where soldiers performed heroically, you know, like they charged a machine gun nest or they dove on top of a grenade or they did these things that seemed like it was completely counter to self-preservation. And they wanted to like, why do soldiers do those kind of things? What are the conditions that put the soldier in that place where he would do that? And they found that it has nothing to do with your love of your country. It has nothing to do with how hard you train or the discipline of the unit. The number one answer that every surviving soldier gave was that I thought my friends were in trouble. And so the idea behind the cohort program was that we were supposed to, they created these unique situations that sort of forced us into becoming a band of brothers. and really to enhance those relationships between the troops in a way that we're compelled to look at our, you know, squad mates and platoon mates and company mates as, you know, our most important social connections. And so there was all kinds of crazy stuff that they did. Like there was so 6 bathroom stalls, 3 facing 3, and they took the doors off the bathroom stalls so that in basic training, if you're going to go to the bathroom, you were looking your buddy in the eye. And so that and a whole number of other weird situations that they put us in. And normally when you go to basic training, you go to basic training with a bunch of guys, and then you go to your advanced individual training, and that initial unit gets broken up, and then each person goes to their, you know, advanced school. And then when you're done with that advanced individual training, then you get sent across the world to different duty stations. Well, in the cohort program, everyone went to basic training together. Everyone went to advanced individual training together. And then everybody went to the same duty station up in Fort Lewis. And so already we were in this place of, we were in an experimental unit in the Army's most experimental division. And so, you know, we had a lot of, like, again, unusual training protocols and things that definitely weren't normal. And we would always, they always would, were giving us injections or something. You know, and I'm inoculated against, I think, 5 different kinds of plague and every jungle disease that's out there. And so you get a lot of shots is what I'm trying to tell you. And, you know, back when I was 19, I joined the Army to be in the Army. Like, I wasn't there to, you know, half-ass it. I was there to, you know, be a soldier and do all the soldier things. And so anytime there was something to volunteer for, even if it sounded like the lamest, you know, maintenance duty, I would always raise my hand. I was always there to do whatever the unusual thing was. And I remember one time, you know, you get a lot of shots. And one time they wanted me to sign certain paperwork before this one series of them. And, you know, I don't even know what it said, but I was like, sure, whatever, hoo-ah. And you sign the paper, get the shots. and so you have to understand, before I joined the Army, you know, I went to private Jesuit all boys school. I was a huge Dungeons and Dragons nerd. I barely passed the strength test to get into the Army. Like, it was, the doctor's like, could you try that again? So, and you know, I wasn't a great student, when I was in high school. And so, like, that's the sort of context of me going into the military, and then joining this experimental unit voluntarily, and then having these unusual experiences. Well, what began to happen was suddenly there were a lot of things that seemed not to be in a straight line from where I was coming from. So not long after signing on those injections, my running time went to 5 minutes and 20 seconds in a mile, which is unusually fast. And I got assigned to this, what they called a super squad running team. And so we would go out and, you know, just this whole unit is probably 10 guys, and we could all run that fast. And I found that there was a number of other, like, strength things. You know, I'd go to the gym and I'd sit down on, like, one of the Nautilus machines. And for certain machines, like, the whole stack of weight on it was no problem for me. And, you know, you could chalk that up easily to, you know, your body still maturing or whatever. And hard to say exactly what was going on. And again, I don't want to oversell this idea because I don't have any.
You were a super soldier, but it's okay. Keep going.
well, it's not like Nick Fury and I chat on the phone at all. And then I think there was two. So, like, those are kind of subjective things. Like, okay, well, you were running kind of fast and, you know, you were doing okay in the gym. But there are two tests that soldiers take. One is called the skill qualification test. And basically, they give you a phone book of information. It's, you know, 8.5 by 11 and probably 3 inches thick. And it covers everything that a infantry soldier is supposed to know how to do. Everything from nuclear, biological, and chemical warfare, urban operations, identifying enemy vehicles, first aid, radio work, you know, all the different skills that a soldier needs to know how to do. And so, you know, everyone had to study for that test. And they told me that I got the second highest score in Fort Lewis that year. So there are, I think, 40,000 troops on Fort Lewis at the time. And in fact, they said, well, you got every answer right, except one of the questions that you answered had a answer that was more right than the one that you gave. And so there was another guy on the base that got that question correct. So there was this, you know, objective score of, yeah, you maxed out this test that they give to every soldier. There's also the U.S. Army's highest peacetime award is called the Expert Infantryman's Badge. And so while the skill qualification test is, you know, a written exam, what do you know? The Expert Infantryman's Badge requires, there's 34 different task tests that you have to do. And they include, you know, qualifying expert with your rifle, you know, 12-mile road marches with 90 pounds. You have to move under laser-simulated direct fire. You have to, you know, range estimate. You have to do, you know, first aid, and treat sucking chest wounds. Like, there's this whole series of tests that you do. If you get any task wrong, you get, I think you get two chances to retest. And if you don't, then you're out. And less than 1% of all soldiers ever earn this award. And in my first year there, you know, this was after the injections, you know, this skinny kid from Ohio who was playing Dungeons and Dragons in his parents' basement just a few months before earned the U.S. Army's highest peacetime award. And it's, like I said, it's all task-based. So you have to actually perform the tasks. You know, it includes running and push-ups and sit-ups and all of the physical requirements, plus the shooting and land navigation and day and night. And with the land navigation, basically you're given a compass and what they call a direction, a distance, and an azimuth. Azimuth is sort of your compass reading. And you're sent out at night, and the course is, you know, several miles large. And you literally have to walk around at night and find coffee cans pinned to trees in the middle of the forest. And if you get the first one wrong, you're never going to get the rest of them. And you're not allowed to carry a flashlight. You just have to go up there and use the glow-in-the-dark spots in your compass and, you know, what you figured out in terms of your map headings, how to get there. So it's a long story to say that there's a lot of circumstantial evidence that something happened to me when I was in the military that changed some sort of way that my body and mind operate. And, you know, again, I, for the longest time, I thought, oh, that's kind of weird, but I really couldn't make any for sure kind of conclusions about it. Then I was out of the Army for about almost 10 years, and they called me up and asked me if I'd be willing to participate in an intensive physical. So this is weird because none of my Army unit mates, you know, none of the guys that I was in with got the same request. And they paid for my transportation to another city. And they put me up for 3 days and they ran this exhaustive battery of tests. And so they were doing things like testing my nerve velocity and cognitive abilities. They determined that my lung capacity was at the top 2% of all human beings on Earth. And they also found that my pain tolerance was exceeded their instrument's ability to measure it. And so they have this strange spring-loaded contraption, and they push it into the soft joints of your body. And they say, as soon as you start to feel pain, give us an indication and we'll stop pressing it. And then they could measure the amount of pressure that they put into that sensitive joint spot. And I remember them like pushing it all the way in, and it maxed out their scale. And he was looking at me like, are you feeling into this? And of course, you know, you can feel it, but it's not painful. And so he thought that there was something broken with the device he was using. So he went and got another one, and that one maxed out too. So then he went and got another doctor to help him administer the test. And again, like, I could, you know, there was data that I was receiving that something was pushing on my joints, but in terms of pain, it wasn't there. They seemed pretty, freaked out about that. And, so after that first day of testing, during the second day of testing, this sort of group of nurses and doctors started following me around and, you know, watching the testing that was done. They got to this battery of cognitive tests, which have to do with how you organize information. And they were all kind of wowed by the results there, which were indicating, you know, this unusual ability to quickly organize information and sort things and things like that. Kind of complicated to explain exactly what the tests were like. And so it was really this kind of strange thing about, you know, coming back and then finding these verifiable sort of extremes of human ability were the results of these, you know, 10 years later test after getting out of the Army. The weird thing is that, so I was in the Army during the 80s, right at the end of the Cold War. And during my first year, the wall in Berlin fell. And so the funding for my unit actually dried up. And so they were talking about letting us out early and doing a bunch of other stuff. And then whole thing with the first Gulf War flared up right after that. And so my unit was desert ready and combat trained. And so the unit changed designation a couple of different times, you know, after we lost funding. And we eventually became the 199th Special Battalion. And it was the strangest thing because they gave us these patches. And the patch looked like there's a devil's head. You know, you could see its eyes and its mouth. And there was a spear going through the head. And then there was these sort of yellow angel wings behind it. And so we got issued all these patches. And then I think someone in the higher up in the military said, oh, that's a problem. And so they made the patch, they made them take the devil's eyes and the devil's mouth off the patch. So it just sort of looked like this, you know, spear going through an explosion, like this red devil head explosion kind of thing. But I remember it was the strangest thing that they didn't want there to be this. They wanted to make these alterations so this devil head would not appear in our patch as explicitly a devil. Anyway, we were combat ready and desert trained during the first Gulf War. And they told us that we weren't going to go because we were being held in reserve for some other potential military action. And so my unit trained thousands of National Guardsmen who wound up going over to fight in Desert Storm. But for whatever reason, this unit, which was, like I said, combat ready and desert trained, we were not deployed with the explicit instructions that we were being held in reserve for some other potential activity somewhere else in the world. Never did find out what that was. Eventually, we won the Gulf War fairly quickly. And it was the strangest thing. I had a precognitive dream about having a meeting with my first sergeant. And in this dream, he said, I've got four slots. I can let four of you guys go early, you know, leave your military contract early, but you need to give me a good reason as to why. So that was the dream that I had. And then 2 days later, that exact experience happened with the same soldiers that were in my dream. And I knew exactly what to tell them. You know, I want to go to college and I've got this, you know, the semester starting. And so I got one of the slots to get out early because of that precognitive dream. And so, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, even now it's, I don't have any proof. Like no one's calling me up and asking me to join the Avengers or anything like that. But there are still times, you know, even now I'm in my 50s and, you know, I'll go to the gym and have that same experience with the stack of weights. Or, you know, I will, you know, stupid little things like play a Sudoku game, like that numbers game where you're logically trying to figure out what's going on. And I'll set it to the highest setting and typically will beat 100% of all other users for speed on the most difficult setting. And again, I'm not trying to make any giant claim, that I've got, you know, some kind of legitimate super soldier thing or whatever. But it is, there's a lot of strange coincidences that don't seem to make sense under other explanations.
Yeah. Well, listen, you sound like Captain America. And so, I mean, when you started describing it, I was like, did they lay him down in like some weird pod where he grew? And he comes out, he's like, I'm ripped. But I mean, like, it definitely sounds like whatever they put in you it had a serious effect on you. It's a lasting effect. So have you ever felt like there's a degradation of ability, strength, intellect, or anything? Because I mean, you're saying you weren't great in school academically, and now like you're able to do things on a mental level that maybe you traditionally wouldn't have had the ability to do. Has there ever been any kind of reverse effect where you start feeling like you're getting dumber or something?
I will say that, after I got out of the Army, my buddies and I did a lot of mountaineering. And, you know, so if I get out when I was maybe 23, something like that, when I was 30, I climbed 6 10,000-foot mountains in 6 months. And one of them was Mount Rainier, which is considered the most grueling endurance climb in the lower 48 states. And so on that particular mission, two of the people bagged out at 10,000 feet from altitude sickness. And so then we were climbing with a good friend of mine, I think two good friends of mine, and then two people I didn't know very well that hadn't ever climbed it before. And one of them, he spilled all the fuel out of his stove, and so he couldn't make water for himself, but he was too embarrassed to tell anyone about it. And so he stopped drinking water. And eventually he went into, he got dehydrated and then went into shock. And so we had to triage him and get him sort of stabilized. And so, you know, we did the summit. I'm laughing because one of my Army buddies was with me, Marty, and Marty hadn't prepared for this climb, and he almost died on it as well. But anyway, we got to the summit, and my goal was to do 50 push-ups at the summit, and I started doing that push-ups, and Marty looked at me, and I realized that was going to be, he was going to kill me if I continued, so I had to stop that plan. But we got this one climber who was compromised back down to base camp. And we had planned to walk off the mountain that day, and but he couldn't move. And so, the rest of the crew was exhausted. And so that day I did 18 hours of continuous mountain travel. And so that was 10 years after this initial injections, right? And so even 10 years after, there seemed to be significant advantages in terms of respiration and endurance and all those other kind of things. Because I don't know if you've ever climbed mountains before, but 18 hours of continuous mountain travel is a pretty significant ordeal. Yeah. And so I would say that the only thing that's really happened is that my knee joints are creaky now. And so I don't do as much running and swimming and those kind of things as I used to. But in terms of cognitive abilities, throughout my career, you notice, so one of the primary benefits is being able to take a vast field of information and condense it down into the fulcrum of what's the most important thing, and to be able to do that at extreme speed, right? And so what happens a lot of times in my professional life is I will be able to see an outcome clearly through extrapolation long before anyone else in the room arrives at that conclusion. And so that can be a little frustrating. Oftentimes you just have to wait for the inevitable thing to unfold as you predicted it would before people understand that, oh, okay, you knew what you were talking about. But I feel weird talking about all this stuff to begin with, just because I don't have any proof, there's no way to verify it. And, everyone thinks they're smarter than they probably are. So
Well, not me. I openly admit I'm stupid and dumb and people should listen to me. I'm like, here's a new theory, but don't take my word for it, please. No, I mean, listen, I think it's fascinating. And I mean, shoot, you're like 18 hours. 18 hours doing anything is crazy, you know? I mean, I don't remember the last time I walked for 18 hours. Probably never. So, but so, when's the last time you did any like kind of physical testing? I mean, like you mentioned about the mile, how you did 520. When's the last time you did a mile? I mean, I know your joints are creaking and stuff, but I mean, was it like 10 years ago or what?
You know, I remember I was going to the gym regularly 3 years ago before we moved down to the gorge. And it was even then that, you know, the working at the, like the weight machines, in the gym, there were still, I was like, wow, I'm still kind of maxing some of this. And it's weird because it's not all muscle groups, like triceps, absolutely, abdominals, absolutely, thighs, you know, those kind of things, are all easily maxed. And that was, like I said, 3-4 years ago that that was going on. And there's other like weird things, like, it's not uncommon for like a metal tool that I'm working with to break in my hands. So like a hammer will break, you know, if I'm, you know, or pry bar will bend or whatever. And that's, you know, could be cheap tools. But it's just one of those kind of things that
you're trying to be so humble right now.
like, well, like, I mean, it's probably Harbor Freight. It is.
I mean, listen, man, like I don't bend tools. I don't break hammers. Even the Harbor Freight ones, man, like, you know, so when you say maxing out certain muscle groups and stuff, what muscle groups aren't the ones that tend to get maxed out on certain exercises?
So, biceps aren't a maxing one, but triceps easily, you know? And so it's weird stuff like that. And again, like, who knows? I mean, it could be a dozen things. And I'm not a small guy. You know, when I joined the Army, I was 6'3", and now I'm 6'5". And so, you know, part of the package of being big, I guess. But anyway, you know, we could go on and speculate about things that I have no proof for, and there's no way to, you know, go back and figure it out. I mean, it's interesting, but I'm not, like I said, Nick Fury isn't calling me. I don't hang out with Tony Stark. I run a outdoor store in Columbia River Gorge.
Yeah, you're just hanging out with Tony. You're hanging out with Tony Merkel, not Tony Stark. Wrong Tony.
You know, I think you're probably more fun, but that's just my opinion.
I appreciate it. I wish I had Stark's money though. So I just want to say that, you know, I've heard stories like this over the years that you're sharing, and I do wonder, just no proof of anything, right? But I do wonder if it was just some kind of, because, you know, I don't know how else to say it other than, you know, when you're in the military, you kind of, you're their property. That's what I hear. And so since you're their property, they're maybe testing some things on you. Maybe that's why, you know, certain things were enhanced and other things weren't, because they were literally testing out certain things. And maybe no proof of anything, like you would say, but maybe there are somebody out there that got the full dose of the whole package and they're running around just absolutely jacked to no man's end, mentally, physically. They're flying through the sky or something. I don't know. But I think it's a really interesting story. And, you know, it just kind of sheds light on this idea that, you know, when you're in the military, you know, weird things can tend to happen. I mean, we've had different things like that happen on the show where people are sharing stories from their experiences in military. And I find those stories just very interesting. But you lay that groundwork. We went into this direction, but because you mentioned about the spatial displacement that you experienced, and you're like, let me lay the groundwork with my military experience as to why it's so weird that I would lose place. Now I understand. Like, you don't just get lost.
No. Yeah, and so, you know, a part of it. You know, How do I say it? Well, I know that I've had capabilities that are at the edge of the bell curve. We'll just say it like that. And so that's why I volunteered to be a search and rescue EMT. You know, it was one of those things where if you have capabilities, you have a responsibility to use those in a way that helps others. And so, of course, we had intensive land navigation training. Like in the Army, land navigation is literally a life and death skill. If you're successful, people die. If you're not successful, people die. And so the level of training that we had on that was pretty intensive. And then, of course, in search and rescue, there's a whole nother set of life and death consequences to not having your act together when it comes to land navigation. Like you really have to be no mistakes, right? You can't be out there trying to help somebody else and get yourself into trouble to a point where you need rescue yourself, right? And so, and then even within that, within my unit, I was recognized as one of the best navigators. And this may be a previous genetic thing. We talked during the last time we chatted about magnetite crystals in people's brains and how that's a physical mechanism by which things like magnetic navigation occurs in migrating animals and things like that. And I'm fairly certain that people in my family have just that magnetic navigational sense is just part of our genetic package. My daughter, I'll take her out for a hike around the house and we'll go into the woods and I'll have her hiking for 45 minutes and I'll say, okay, point to where our house is. And within, you know, 10 degrees, she knows where we're at. And so it's kind of one of those family traits of knowing where you are. And so because of that, I was often put in the role of navigator on, you know, training missions and then in search and rescue, obviously the same thing. And there's a number of things you do when you are an experienced land navigator. Like you are always, you're keeping a pace count. You're setting down, you know, sort of mental markers about where things are. You're building mental maps. You're keeping an eye on where the sun is at. So there's this whole constellation of like background routines that are running always when you're in the forest. And so because of that, I literally cannot remember a time that I was lost in the woods, in the wilderness. Like I've always known where I am. And more importantly, if there's ever a place that I've been, I know it, right? Like it's sort of like if you've seen a face before, like you recognize the face. Some people are really, really good at that, others less so. For me, that's what it's like when I'm in the wilderness. Like I always know if I've been in a place before and which direction I approach it from and which direction the exit is and everything else. Like that's just part of the package, right? So paint a little more of a picture of like just how mysterious this area called Brooklyn Barrows is. So back in 2014, a guy named Chris Zitzowitz was out with a friend of his and they were looking for caves in Brooklyn Barrows. On some maps, the area is called the Big Lava Bed. So if folks are looking for it, it's in between Mount St. Helens and Mount Adams, about 7 miles north of the Columbia River. And so they were out there looking for cave entrances, and they got separated by about 20 yards. And then Chris vanished from the face of the earth. Not a single clue has ever been found as to his whereabouts. And so this gets kind of a really weird. So he went missing. His partner called the sheriff's department immediately. They immediately began a search. The search wound up eventually including hundreds of searchers, right? They had dogs, they had choppers, and they found nothing. Not a Snickers bar wrapper, not a shoelace, not a scrap of clothing, not a footprint. They found no trace of Chris, completely vanished from the face of the earth. And in fact, they had done so much searching that they began to suspect his hiking partner of foul play. And this guy passed several truth verification tests that he had no ill will towards Chris and, you know, had committed no crimes or done anything untoward. And, you know, I've talked to several folks in the store who've come in and told me their experiences. Some of them were on the search and rescue team. This was, I was on a search and rescue team up north near Seattle and I wasn't here in the gorge when this person went missing. And they said, there's a really strange story about military involvement with this particular search. A whole army unit showed up claiming that they just happened to be in the area doing training and they figured they'd help with the search. Now, I've been both a soldier, ground pounder, one of the guys that would have shown up in this particular scenario. And I've also been a search and rescue guy. And I can tell you, from a search and rescue perspective, I've been on dozens and dozens of missions. The only time the military ever shows up is if they're bringing a chopper. And then you just, you know, see the guy giving you the two fingers salute through the window, and that's about it. In this case, they had a whole unit out there searching. And they said that they were some from some kind of special forces unit, and they thought that they could be of assistance, which is wildly suspicious in my mind. Like, there's really no reason why the Army would ever get involved in that. You know, typically, you know, my unit, we wound up fighting forest fires in Yellowstone back in 88, but that was because all the forest firefighting units were exhausted at that point. And that was when Yellowstone was on fire and it was a huge disaster. And so we got sent out there to help out with that effort. But you never deploy the Army for a civilian person missing. Like, that's just one guy. It didn't make any sense. Well, you have to understand that just probably 3 weeks ago now, a woman came into the store and she said that her and eight of her friends, so nine witnesses, they were laying in a field just south of Broke Leg Burrows. And they were watching, this is September of 2023. Yeah. They're watching shooting stars. And then they see these two lights that look like satellites. So two white spots. And I don't know if any of your listeners have ever seen satellites in the sky, but basically they just look like a star that's moving fast. So they see these two satellites moving fast over sky, overhead. There are no navigational lights, no red and yellow lights that you'd find on an aircraft. And as she's telling me the story, I thought, oh, I hope this isn't one of those Starlink stories. Because a lot of folks will come to the store excited that they've seen some kind of UFO and it's just Elon Musk's satellite array, which is kind of a letdown. But so I was hoping that, you know, she had a legitimately cool experience. And then she said something that I had never heard before. She said, as those satellites got directly over us, a green sheet-like laser shot out of it, scanned the tree line, went down the trees, across the field, over them, and then back up the other trees, and then disappeared. And she said, we were totally freaking out. And so this is a, you know, a thing that was co-witnessed by nine people. And very bizarre experience. We started to investigate what was going on with that. And it turns out that there are some LIDAR mapping missions. Right. So the Washington Department of Natural Resources will use LIDAR, which is a kind of radar that allows you to see things, terrain without the vegetation on it. And so I called up those guys and I said, hey, did you guys have any missions last summer in this area? And they said, well, no. And number two, the LIDAR we use is infrared. And so you would never see any kind of, beam coming out of our aircraft. And we always fly in the early morning or during the hours of daylight. All right. So they're not a nighttime type of flyer. And they said the only time that you see a green laser is when someone is doing bathymetric studies. And so they're trying to determine the terrain underwater. And so the green laser allows you to see underwater. But in this area, you know, there's no bodies of water where they were getting scanned. And they said, you know, so it definitely wasn't our guys. And we talked to our vendors who do the LIDAR flights. You know, they're civilian contractors who help them with this stuff. And they said, yeah, we never fly at night. And we don't use green lasers. They said the only place that you might find green laser use would be in the military. And you're not going to get any answers out of them. And so we've got this really weird situation where we had nine witnesses scanned by a green laser just south of Broke Leg Burrows. And the one governmental agency who might have had anything to do with it, is saying that it wasn't them. So it's just, again, building a little bit of the strangeness of the area. As I mentioned, there is one four-wheel drive track. It's a scratch into the southern quadrant of this thing. And I have been driving around the outside of my vehicle for months trying to find this access point. Because I'd heard rumors about it. People came into the store talking about how neat it was. And so I finally found it and I drove in there. And a part of this area was apparently hit by lightning or something because none of the trees are alive. And it's almost like you're driving through this crazy moonscape, right? It's utterly quiet because these jumbled rocks with moss on them, like, just eats the sound. And you get this really eerie sense when you're in there. And this track leads to these pools of water that are sort of in these volcanic depressions. And there is no other reason for this road. Like, normally, you know, we've got a lot of like Forest Service roads out here where they'll send out, you know, logging trucks to go extract timber or mining vehicles to extract minerals. But here, there's nothing of economic value. This road just leads to these mysterious pools of standing water in these volcanic crevasses. And there's a campfire site out there. So I'm poking around at this campfire and I find a bunch of 5.56 NATO cartridges laying on the ground. And so an M4 and M16 uses 5.56 casings, bullets or cartridges, I should say. And what was weird is that as I'm looking at this, these old cartridges laying on the ground, it looks like they were firing in all directions. And I was like, that's unusual, but not inexplicable. Good old boys, if they've got an AR-15, it'll fire either 223 or 5.56, depending on how well the weapon is built. And so it could just be, you know, regular folks out there having fun shooting in the woods. But the weird thing was that I found metal belt links. And so when I was in the military, I carried a squad automatic weapon, M249, they call it a SAW. And it is a belt-fed machine gun that fires 5.56 rounds. So basically, it's a squad gun that fires the same type of bullets as everyone else's rifle, but you can lay down massive amounts of suppressive fire with it. And I found, and so the bullets are carried in a belt link. So these, they have these metal links that hold the bullets together. And then once you fire them, the links fly apart. And I found a handful of those belt links in and amongst these 5.56 empty spent cartridges that look like they had been fired in all directions. And so that's really kind of what made me start scratching my head, because no civilian in the United States is allowed to carry, own, or use a belt-fed machine gun. And here we have apparent evidence that there was some type of military activity going on here, firing belt-fed machine guns in this strange volcanic spot. So again, completely inconclusive evidence. I can't really say anything else about it. There could be a dozen explanations as to why that was there. But to me, one of those things that you put in the column of, okay, something may have happened here and we don't know quite what. So to get to my personal experience, I was out there and there's a road that goes alongside of this thing. And it's almost like, you know, like if you go to like a wildlife park and the road drives and you can look in and see all the critters, like it's sort of like that, where there's this road and it's a deep forest road. So like there's no other cars on it typically. And then you can see like these crazy crumpled up rock formations and these strange slabs and all of this utter wildness that is the Brooklyn Boroughs. And I wanted to get some drone footage in there. And so I parked my car and I walked 200 yards into Brooklyn Boroughs. And rough terrain. You couldn't put two steps in front of each other without having to change the position of your foot. And it chews up boots. Like it will eat a boot sole and you'll have to get them replaced if you spend any amount of time in there. And I found this trench. So this is again, one of those lava tubes that the roof had collapsed and you get this really cool trench, probably running 60 yards, right? And so I flew the drone up and down this trench a bunch of times, you know, trying to get that GPS lock, not getting a GPS lock. And then at the south end of the trench, the drone hit a branch and fell to the ground. So I went down there, picked up the drone, and figured I'd do a little more exploring, see what was going on deeper in Broke Lake Barrows. So in order to understand this spatial displacement experience, I'm going to try to set up some basic landmarks. So imagine that I am standing in a trench. We'll call it trench one. And I'm starting at the south end of a north-south trench, right? So I walk to the north end of trench one. I take a left turn 90 degrees. And now I'm going to go deeper west into Broke Lake Barrows, see what else is out there, right? And again, now this is a place where we've had these reports of Sasquatch footprints, vocalizations, trees getting knocked over. We've had Chris Zitzewitz going missing. We've had this strange military presence, both during his search and apparently over at the pools, which are a couple miles south of where I was at the time. And I walk 300 yards west, right? So I took this, went from north, from south to north, turned west, walked 300 yards west. And then I find another really cool trench. And I think, oh, well, I better fly the drone here. And so I'm flying the drone and I'm there for about 5 minutes. And I look over my shoulder and I see my car. I go, well, wait a minute. How can that possibly be? I should be 500 meters away from my car. And here it is, 150 meters away. What the hell happened? And then, like waking up from a dream, I realized that I was at the south end of trench one. So the place where I had started from, I thought that I was 350 meters and probably 110 degrees different direction than I was. And I have no idea, no clue, no, it's a seamless mental edit of how I got from what I thought was 300 yards deeper west into Broke Lake Barrows to being bounced back to place where I started at the south end of the first trench that I had walked through. Completely blew my mind. So utterly discombobulating. I can't even explain to you how, for a guy who always knows where he is in the woods, always knows how far I've traveled in a particular direction, to suddenly find myself in a place that I had already been with no recollection, no even beginning of a clue how I had arrived back in the place where I had started. And even crazier, I was standing there literally flying the drone up and down a place where I had already flown that drone, like had already paid attention to this landscape and having no idea that I was back at the place that I already was. Like, again, the only reason why I told you that whole story about my military experience and my search and rescue experience is to let you know that it's not some noob running around in the woods, mistakenly getting lost. This is a situation where I cannot explain in any way, shape, or form how I was transported, what I believe to be 350 yards from where I thought I was. Utterly just confounding. And, you know, at first it was unsettling. And then I began to think, you know, this place is so large and so remote. There are no trails in there. Like, you could literally have three Ewok villages of Sasquatches living there and no one would ever know. And I thought, you know, if this was some way that they were protecting their territory and they didn't want me to go deeper into this place, this is probably the most benevolent way to have done that, to sort of shut down your consciousness, lift you up, transport you back to go, and then set you there. No harm, no terrifying experience, just a benevolent bouncing you back to the starting point. And of course, you know, I get into my car and it's hours later than I thought it was. So a really fascinating experience, and but also super exciting. Like, you have to understand, I've been hearing people report these things for years now. And to actually get out there into this place, mysterious and weird and amazing as it is, and then immediately to have this kind of off the charts experience of spatial displacement, I was thrilled. Like, I thought it was really amazing. Just what a neat experience to have.
I was thrilled. It was amazing. I loved it.
Well, let me think about it. Like, the reason why I do this is because I love living in a place where all the questions aren't answered, where there's still things to experience a sense of wonder about, right? Like that we've got 11 foot tall creatures walking around in 2 feet. We've got these 4 foot tall giant cats that they're orbs that I've taken pictures of. And now to have this experience where something which, like I said, as a professional land navigator, I know my shit, right? Like that is not a James got mixed up or James got disoriented or there was something about this guy that he just got lost in the woods. No, like I am the person that you call when someone else is lost. I am the person that has the skills and the experience to rescue other people who are in really, really dangerous situations and oftentimes hurt. And to be that guy and have this experience where even in this small scale kind of thing where we're talking about a couple hundred yards to have been completely bounced and relocated. I mean, like, again, it's one of those things. It's a personal experience. I can hope that you guys understand and believe me and take me at my word. But to me, it was utterly game changing. My family was sick of me talking about it just for weeks. It's like, all they was talking, oh my gosh. And, you know, against my better judgment, like I would never, as a search and rescue person, you have a responsibility to not put people in harm's way. And I would never recommend anyone go into this place because it is like, you will get yourself hurt. Like there are razor sharp rocks out there. Like it is, and the terrain is unpredictable and compasses don't work and cell phones don't work. But I have to tell you, I am so fascinated by this place. It's like sort of my new white whale. Like it's the one thing that I definitely want to go into deeper and, you know, maybe camp out there and see what kind of strange things will happen next.
Oh, I totally understand that feeling. I have my own little white whale area and we actually experienced spatial displacement a little bit. We're not sure what exactly happened. And that's why I don't get too excited about it. Cause I'm like, well, maybe we're just stupid. And we just didn't exactly understand what was going on. So when you were out there, this is the area that the military had, you know, questionable activity. This is the area that the green lasers were being shot, right?
Mm-hmm.
This wasn't the, like the same time though, right? Like you weren't out there searching for the missing person that they were searching for.
No. These are three different events separated into.
Gotcha. So you're out there, you have the spatial displacement. What does your gut tell you happened there? I mean, cause like some people might say, bro, you might've been abducted. You might like, and they put you back at your car and that's why there's hours later and all that stuff. I mean, what's the lot? Cause it seems like you try to be as logical as possible, everything, but you had this, excuse me. I just choked my own spit there. there's a first for everything. But you had this kind of like, illogical experience that you went through that took you by storm. And as somebody who runs a store that's taking illogical experiences from the local public, for you to have that own personal experience, how do you personally define it for yourself? I mean, is it just something that you just can't explain? Or do you have this suspicion as to what exactly kind of might have happened there?
You know, it's a good question. And like the fun ideas are that a mystical band of Sasquatches snuck up on me and edited my memories and gently placed me in a place where I couldn't hurt myself or discover their home. Like, that's fanciful, obviously. Like, I have zero evidence other than wishful thinking that this would happen to me. Right. but, you know, to me, it's a huge mystery. I can't even begin to explain it. Like the notion that my memories were so seamlessly edited and the sensation that I had that like once I recognized that I was actually in a place that I had already been, it was almost like that fog of waking up. You know what I mean? Like I have no recollection of falling asleep. I have no recollection of waking up. I just have the feeling of, wait a minute, you know, sort of like rubbing your eyes and like, am I where I think I am? Like, how did this happen? And So yeah, it's something, whatever it was, that has the ability to erase memories. And not only that, like seamlessly edit the experience. It's not like there's a missing piece. It's not like I was like, oh, okay, well, I'm walking and then suddenly there's like this moment where I'm, you know, there's black and then I'm at this place. It's like, nope. I thought that I was happily marching myself west, you know, staying on azimuth, doing all the land navigation things that you're supposed to do. And lo and behold, I am back at go and utterly befuddled that I'm looking at scenery that I had already studied and already understood. So I wish that's kind of why I want to go back out there. I need more data. Like I can't explain what happened to me, with any theory that I currently have, or an understanding of, you know, how cognitive processes work that would allow.
That was the last time you were out there?
No, no. Well, and it gets snowed. Right now, the snow is just now melting off the area. And so this happened late last year, right before the area got snowed in. And so now I am starting to poke around the edges. So like I said, this place is just filled with these wondrous things. Like right now, there's this area that is just northeast of the Barrows, like literally like across the road from the northeast corner of it. And every year, this place called South Prairie, the forest fills up like a lake. And so you've probably seen like videos or pictures on the internet of like people swimming through a forest. Well, like that happens right here at South Prairie, which is at the north corner of Broke Lake Barrows. And so this seasonal lake forms, and it's literally the kind of thing where you can swim through the forest. And then every year in a single day, that lake, which is like a half mile wide, suddenly disappears. Wow. And no one is sure where it goes. And there are theories that there is a labyrinth of lava tube caves that run underneath Broke Lake Barrows, and that they get clogged with ice, and then that ice like dam breaks, and then the entire thing drains because you don't see the water like fill up any river or anything like that. It just suddenly one day is gone. And it's things like that where, again, like this is a place where there are all these wondrous things that occur that we still don't even have a clear understanding of what's happening. And like, I've heard people say that they were walking out in Broke Lake Barrows and they were stepped on top of like sort of a large, like rocky mound. And then they hear something underneath their feet, like they had knocked a rock loose in a void, and they hear it fall for a couple of seconds, hit something, and then fall for a couple more seconds and then hit the ground. Like some kind of gigantic cavern underneath their feet. And so what happened here, we don't know. And, you know, Chris is not the only one that's gone missing. There have been, you know, mushroom pickers and fern pickers and other folks that have just over the years have just vanished and no clue, no trace. And to me, like, that's like, there's something happening out there. I don't know what it is, but man, I am sure hot to figure it out. Like, to me, like, that's like one of the grand mysteries of, it sounds like a really satisfying project to get into.
Yeah, for sure. So it sounds like it's almost like with what they're describing underneath their feet, like maybe even the earth just kind of like somehow opens up and swallows people at times. I mean, if the water is just going somewhere, I'm assuming it's not going up. The logical explanation would be it's going down. Somehow it's draining down into something. Yeah. I'm going to get weird with you now.
I'm here for you.
I can't let the episode go without bringing up portals. And like, I mean, what? So you have this guy, Chris, that went missing, no trace. You experienced this spatial displacement where you should have been I think you said 350 meters away from where you found yourself. And so what are the odds? What are the ideas? I mean, and feel free to disagree or, you know, say it's crazy, but like, what if it's a portal location and there's like this area has some kind of portal sensitivities where it displaces people or just, you know, takes them into somewhere else.
Yeah.
I mean, shoot, if the ground is empty and hollow, I mean, now we're talking about portals to the upside down and Stranger Things. I mean, who knows?
The notion of portals, like we have had reports of portals in the store several times. Several folks have had that experience. And so we've had reports. So there's a story that in Mount Adams, some people could see a physical hangar door open and close and craft fly in and out of it. But one guy came out of the store and said that he saw what appeared to be a portal hovering in the sky next to the summit of the mountain. And the other folks have had strange experiences like that, Lost Time, sort of in that same area at a place the locals call Monster Mountain. We get reports, other people have reports of spatial displacement where they're traveling and then suddenly they find themselves back at their car and they, you know, should have been hours hiking away from it. And then recently we've had this rash of really interesting reports. So we have reports of triangular shaped UFO flying over the area, typically moving fairly slow. Commonly, it's reported that it's a black shaped slab triangle. One guy said back in the 80s, he was driving down 14. He saw it flying above the river when he was driving on the road with other folks in the car. It was 400 feet away. Like, that's really, really close. Like a little bit more than a football field. And then the whole car, all the witnesses saw this thing dive into the river and they could see its lights underwater. They thought that they had witnessed some kind of plane crash or something like that. And, you know, they called the FAA and the local airports and there was nothing to report. But the reason why I bring it up now is that several people have come into the store recently and said, I've seen a triangle shape in the sky at dusk, but it looks almost like it's cloaked, like the starlight is wrapping around it. And so you get this sense of, you know, like movie cloaks or like the Predator cloak where it distorts the light around it. And so the first report is like, oh, that's interesting. Second report is like, oh, that's starting to see a pattern. And so we probably had five reports now of these craft that look cloaked, like, and the best way to, like, you can be standing there and this woman's husband right next to her couldn't see what she was seeing, which said, oh, it's so clear. I can totally see that there's this thing. And so originally we had received reports like that of people seeing what appeared to be an area where the background was different than the surrounding background. So imagine you're looking through a portal into another realm or world. You would see the normal background of your everyday world, and then you'd see something different in the area of the portal. And so over by like the Lyle Tunnels, which are maybe 12 minutes east of the store, we've had reports of that kind of phenomenon where somebody sees something which looks like some type of weird visual disturbance. The background of a certain area is not like the rest of the natural scenery around it. And I still don't know whether the phenomenon of cloaked craft is related to this phenomenon of what appears to be a portal. You know what I mean? Like some type of thing that you can walk through or be a place of transport. Now, I will say that there are numerous, they look like rock nests in the area. And these are found both on like Wind Mountain and over by Horse Thief Butte. And it's said that the first peoples who lived here, you know, in prehistory, would create these rock nests. And kids as young as 12 would go to these places on vision quests. And so you'd sit in your rock nest exposed to the elements and you'd wait to be visited by your spirit animal or be transported to another realm. And so like that kind of thing has been going on here for thousands and thousands of years. And there is archaeological evidence all over the place that the first inhabitants of this land were having these extraordinary encounters by simply creating a space, confined space for themselves, and then waiting for visitations. And you know, the tales are wild when you look at the, you know, the anthropological studies and the sociological studies of the people who recorded the Native American traditions and stories and things like that, of people seemingly going on these wild adventures in realms that are similar to our own Earth, but in many ways very different. And so, like I said, all I got for you is there is more mysteries here than I have answers for.
You know, there seems to be hot spots. Let's just keep it in our country that have this kind of stuff going on. And I feel like you and I are very similar in that sense, where we live in areas that have mysterious things going on. I mean, Tennessee has a lot of stuff, but like East Tennessee, East Tennessee, where I live, has the Smoky Mountains. Where you live has mountains. There's something to do with mountains, and even into ancient texts, you know, like even in the Bible, it talks about fallen angels descending on Mount Hermon. And like, there's a lot of talk and idea of portal locations, mountaintops, things like that. It's very fascinating. I want to end on this final question. I'm very serious about this question. If there was a portal that opened up, would you walk through it?
Oh, definitely.
I love you. See, you and I are just the same. Like, I love it. That's great. I mean,
I've spent a lifetime of training and preparation, right? And so part of what's so exciting to me out here is, you know, like there's a point at which, like, you could have your 10 out of 10 experience climbing a mountain, but then you have one experience saving someone's life and your former 10 out of 10 becomes a 5 out of 10, right? Yeah. And so in search and rescue, like, it was like rediscovering the wilderness when I was out there doing work to reunite families and to save lives and to bring closure to families who had lost loved ones in the wilderness. And I'll never forget, like, it's sort of like having amazing outdoor experiences of me just going there was sort of... there was diminishing returns. And then to join search and rescue and to save lives and to help people, like, it sort of renewed my love for the adventure of where you've got something that you're doing that has meaning and purpose, right? And now that I'm here in the gorge and there are these true mysteries that are arising and they're like in my backyard, and I'm fortunate enough to be trusted with people's stories and get a sense of like where some of these things are. To me, like, the next challenge is, okay, do you have the skills to survive in the wilderness? You have the skills to save other people's lives in the wilderness. Now, like, what challenges are going to be presented to you if you walk through that portal? Like, do you have the capabilities, capacity to survive that and to survive it with, you know, grace and, you know, some pluck, and to see what's around that next corner? Like, to me, this is like the new frontier. Mm-hmm. And science, because it's got a materialist paradigm, has sort of left this whole realm of astonishing discoveries and wondrous things to citizen scientists like ourselves. And so we've got this wide running field where we can go out and explore. You know, like, we might have talked about Benjamin Franklin back in 1750. Total whack job. He's out flying kites in lightning storms, looking for this mysterious electricity power, right? But even like Thomas Jefferson, who sent Lewis and Clark out here in 1805 with the Voyage of Discovery, he sent them with instructions to look for cryptids. He told them he wanted them to find proof of a living mastodon, and he wanted them to find proof of an American lion, of all things, right? So Thomas Jefferson was aware of creatures like the Klickitat ape cat that had existed here in the United States. And he was excited to send these guys out to explore, like Lewis and Clark, archetypal explorers. You don't get any cooler than these two guys who are, you know, exploring a land at that time, which was completely unknown to Western minds. And that portal opens. And, you know, my wife makes me carry, you know, one of those in-reach satellite things. So, like, and, you know, and we have a protocol, my wife and I, of me calling in, all right, I'm about to do something really weird. So here's where to look for the body. And, but 100% I'd walk through that thing. That's what it's all about, right? It's like that exploration and discovery. It's having the courage to see what's around the corner. And, you know, to be the joy of a new discovery like that. I can't think of anything cooler.
You know, it's funny because I have the InReach as well. I don't use it often, but I do have this habit. And it's funny you say that because it's not even a conscious thing. But now that you mention it's a subconscious thing, it has to be. Before we go out and we do something stupid and crazy, I tend to text my wife, "I love you." it's funny because like my kids are young. I mean, my son's 6, my daughter's 3. And when I'm out there, before I go out there, actually, I think it's before I go out there is when the most hesitation is for me. A lot of times I'm like, okay, we're getting ready to do this trip. And, you know, it's like all of a sudden I don't want to do it. And it's because like,
so cool we're talking about it, but
yeah. Yeah. And it's just like, cause I think about like, I look at my kids, I'm like, gosh, like it always happens. I think back to my childhood, and I know everybody else has like their own memories and stuff, but I don't remember much from when I was 6. I don't remember much hardly anything when I was 3. And so I think, man, if I go and I don't come back, these kids are never going to remember me. And so I'm like, man, I don't want to go. But then I get out there and I'm like, okay, we're here. We're going to do it. And then I'm just texting my wife, "I love you." You know, because it's just like, I don't know if I'm coming back, but you know, if I don't, just know I loved you. Well,
quick plug, you know, as a search and rescue guy, we found so many people because we would triangulate on their last text, or there's some folks that we would find because they would take a picture before they get lost and then it would get sent to the cloud. And so there are certain things like, even if you don't have coverage in wherever you are, sometimes your phone will find a beacon, you know, a tower. And if you send a text and it doesn't go through, it can still bounce off the tower as you're moving. And I can't tell you how many folks we found using that exact method of triangulation on cell phone towers. So as my plug for public safety is always send a text to tell your loved ones where you are and when you expect to be back and where your car is parked. And then if you are lost, continually text. Don't call because you'll burn your batteries, but text. And like I said, it saves lives. It really, really does. But yeah, I hear you. There's that question. And I think for my wife, she knew what she was getting into when she married me, that, you know, I'm an explorer and an adventurer, and that's where my passion is. And so, you know, and she knew like when I would go out, get called at 3 o'clock in the morning to go on a search and rescue mission, like, yep, that was the thing that I was doing was a good thing. And it was worthy of a little inconvenience in our personal lives to be out there. And so, and she wants me to have this satisfying full experience, you know, and utilize my skills and capabilities. And so, yeah, I hear you though. It's you don't ever want to come back, or not come back at all, I should say.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely want to come back. I don't care how I come back. I just want to come back. So, no, but James, man, listen, I appreciate you spending some time and talk with me. Fascinating stuff. And the way you weave the whole story through, listen, man, you're a super soldier, but you know, I that's my interpretation. It's not you saying it to me, but to the spatial displacement and the weird things in the Columbia River Gorge, just fascinating stuff. People that listen right now that maybe are being introduced to you the first time, let them know where they can find the store and, you know, if they want to come and report the bizarre stuff or check out the outdoor store and all the good stuff that's going on in there.
Sure. So my store is located in Bingen, Washington, which is about 60 miles east of Portland, Oregon. So if you're heading to the gorge, fly into the Portland airport and head east down the gorge about 60 miles. And we're right across the river from Hood River, Oregon. The Hood River is a popular vacation spot. You can go to margiesoutdoorstore.com and you'll see some information we've got up there about some of the things people have encountered. There's also our forms we've got an online form to fill out a paranormal report. We're posting more and more on social media about some of the reports we're getting in the store. So that's going to be Marge's Outdoor Store on Facebook, on Instagram, and on YouTube are the primary places where we post.
Yeah, I'm looking at the website. It's got to be one of the few outdoor stores that has a paranormal section, so, which is awesome. I love it. And, you know, you have a spot here. File your reports so people can just do it online as well. But definitely recommend going in and checking it out. James, man, it's always a pleasure.
It's a joy. You're my favorite.
Well, that's the show, everybody. I really hope you enjoyed it. If you did enjoy it, please share the show with your friends. I don't care where or how you share the show. Just share the show. If you enjoyed it, that's the best thing you can do to help the show grow. Share the show. Also, shout out to my good friend, William Bond, over at Permaculture Consultant. I'm wearing his shirt right now. Go ahead and follow his YouTube channel and his Instagram channel. Thanks in advance. See you next week. And until then, stay safe, take care, and remember, the truth will set you free, but first it'll piss you off. I almost forgot that part. Bye.
Thought my old motto was a VA. I was working four cylinders to death. Put it on me, no teammate. Dreams running on fumes, no rest. You could bargain for my soul for a mansion and a couple billboards, no less. Yeah, thank God for a couple roadblocks. I don't know if I'd have stopped where the road ends. Spent years looking for the real me, always came up missing. Yeah. Try to find it at the bottom of the bottle and I promise ain't sipping. Yeah. Drowning in my vices, I thought I was flying. Yeah. Using darkness for my lighting, missing with the timing. Spent so many years on the sidelines, trying to be the highlight, but under the bright lights, breaking all the guidelines. Yeah, Mr. Bull with no lifelines. Yeah, screaming, I don't need you. Fighting, but I'm free too. Neon lights make a path for my breath, like smoke in the cold every weekend. Spent years looking for the real me, always came up missing. Yeah, try to find it at the bottom of the bottle, and I promise ain't sipping.
Find the one and save big this summer during Haverty's July 4th sale. Right now, everything is on sale from sofas, sectionals, bedroom furniture, and more. Come find your style and celebrate at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
Identity theft can cost more than you think. Drained investment accounts, stolen tax returns, lost wages, expenses for lawyers. It's a lot. That's why LifeLock is backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, which covers up to $1 million each for stolen funds, fees for experts and lawyers, and out-of-pocket expenses. Don't face the burden of identity theft alone. Protect your future and finances with LifeLock. Join now and save up to 30% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
It's called soccer.
It's called football.
Soccer.
Football.
Domino's best deal ever lets you get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99.
Okay, we can agree on that.
Yeah, fully.
So, pineapple? Don't ruin it. Get any pizza, including stuffed crust, with any toppings for $9.99. Finally, something everyone can get behind.
And if the rest disagree, that's between them and Domino's. Which means the only thing left to fight over is who's ordering.
Domino's.
Prices higher for some locations. Excludes XL and specialty pizzas. Select this offer from 6:15 to 7:26. Online only. Size availability varies by crust type. Max 7 toppings. 6 for pan and New York style crust. Minimum purchase required for delivery. Prices, participation, delivery area, and charges may vary.